or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You know, the big real issue related to work at the macro level, of course, is the hollowing out of the middle class. And so over the last year, I've made vigorous attempts to try to get luminaries who are, quote, experts on this to opine as to how do we resurrect the middle class. And I've come away feeling, a little empty. And so I've reached quite a bit further afield. And I decided maybe we need to really, to use the cliche, go out of the box a lot more. So in a couple of minutes, I'm going to talk with one of our leading science fiction writers, but who also is a futurist. That's the why he doesn't like the term futurist, because it implies crystal balls and guesswork and, you know, crystals. He's not. He likes to think of himself more as a strategic foresight guy. But we will we'll talk to him in a few minutes. But there's always a danger. You know, I like statistics. My PhD emphasized statistics a lot. So I tend to talk a lot about, you know, the fact that the labor participation rate is the lowest it's been in the last 35 years, that more than 100 million Americans are enrolled in at least one welfare program, that the actual median family income is at its lowest since 1995, inflation adjusted. But as Barack Obama is very good at doing, he realizes you need to put a human face in all that. So I was I noted with interest an article by a former lawyer. I guess he has time now because he was a former lawyer. Even law, there's an oversupply of lawyers, who wrote an article called 20 Ordinary Americans Talk About the Economic Despair That Is Growing Like a Cancer All Around Him. I guess he's not a professional writer. That's one of the longer titles. 20 Ordinary Americans Talk About the Economic Despair That Is Growing Like a Cancer All Around Them. And I thought it would be a useful way to frame the discussion before we get to the hopeful solutions that my guest and I will kick around, that I read you at least some of these 20 Ordinary Americans' actual report instead of the ha-ha talk that comes out of the media. You know, because obviously when they say, oh, the unemployment rate is down 6.7%, but they obviously don't consider the millions of people who don't get counted, who are either have long given up or who are used to be making a middle class living and now making 10 bucks an hour, McWages, those all count as employed. We all know. I mean, think about it. We all know that on the ground, when human beings, unless you're a superstar, I mean, if you're some math genius, computer science, big data person or biotech person, you're doing just fine. Thank you. Software engineer, you know, or, you know, if you're stuck at the bottom, yeah, you can get a job, a McJob, janitorial or whatever. But if you're in the middle, you know people who are either who have had to take worse jobs or no jobs, or who are scared to death about losing their jobs. Well, here are some of their stories, and I'm going to just read you quotes from these people that it was aggregated by this former lawyer. This guy's name is Zach. I've been struggling since I finished college in the summer of 2010. My dream is to work in the courts, law enforcement, but it's almost impossible to get a call back from an interview. I interviewed with three PDs for a position in the city jail, and in one case I made the final 30 of 300 applicants that applied for the three positions. Final 30 of 300 applicants, three positions. Next person, this is a woman, her screen name is Akita Woman. Keita Woman. She says, quote, I have two master's degrees. I'm 61 years old, and I'm earning $10 an hour. What does that say about the current economy? End quote. Somebody whose screen name is Cincinnati Dave. Quote, I work for one of the banks. I was in mortgages. I saw all this coming, so several months ago I asked to get into another area of the bank, and fortunately for me they granted my request. A lot of people are losing their jobs, and there's really no prospects out there for anything else where the same kind of money could be made. I'm going to make nothing near what I've been earning, but at least I'm grateful to be employed. This is all so sad to watch happen, end quote. Next person is, screen name is just K. What I'm aware of is every person I know who had to switch jobs in the last 5 years took a pay cut. The smallest cut among my friends was 10%. The average was closer to 18%. No, we are headed down a bad road, and we are past the point of no return, end quote. Next one, somebody whose screen name is Makati. Quote, after spending most of my life in the middle class, I now consider myself lower class due to age and income. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. I'm still able to provide myself what I need and some of my wants. I'm like most retirees today. Next one is somebody whose screen name is Robert. Around where I live, things seem okay, but I live in a university town. Go to some of the surrounding towns and it's desolate. Car dealerships closed, entire streets with abandoned stores. The only activity is a one-clerk post office. I know people in our church who are a paycheck away from going over the edge or going over due to a spouse dying and losing one of their Social Security checks. I see grim. More homeless. A local church is feeding many more, including some folks living out of their cars. Lots of kids. Mostly minimum wage jobs in the area. If it were not for the university and its 34,000 students, this place would look as bad as the smaller communities. And the next one is somebody whose screen name is TN. We have jobs, mostly part-time or low wage. Our problem these days is so many people are dependent on government programs, no one wants to work. They do better on programs than working, partying, and paying for insurance. Housing is still depressed here. Seeing more homeless around and local churches straining to provide food, crime's up, and drugs, which were down, is coming back with a vengeance. Middle class here are senior citizens on Social Security, younger retirees, not the old ones, the older ones seem to be struggling. Sad, end quote. Next one is somebody whose screen name is Deb. I live in Illinois, about 60 miles southeast of Chicago. The town we live in has 8,000 people in it. Very so-called middle-class farm community. Unemployment's high, and so is the underemployment. We know many people living off two part-time jobs. That seems to be the norm around here. Or people taking jobs they never would have considered in the past just to get by. My son used to work for CAT, I guess that's a Caterpillar tractor in Aurora, but was, quote, let go in order to bring in new workers at a lower pay. Took him over a year, which I guess isn't really that bad, to find a part-time job with 3M. I guess I'll just read two more. There were 20, but I'll just do two more. This one is screen name Susan. Drive around Los Angeles at 3 a.m. any day, and you'll see the devastating and pervasive homelessness from 80-year-olds to 80-year-olds. And the massage parlors and hookers on the streets of used-to-be high-end neighborhoods are exploding. No other way to make a living, end quote. And I'll just do one more. This one, screen name X-San Diego CA. Quote, a couple of years ago, it was reported that 9,000 people a night slept in their cars here in San Diego County. Special car parks are set up in some church parking lots. The cops look the other way. I wonder what the figure is now. I have a rule on this show that I never talk about a problem without offering solutions, or at least hopeful solutions, but this is the problem of our time. Some people call it income inequality. Others call it the hollowing of the middle class. All depends on your political perspectives and what you think the answers are. But as I said, I've devoted many shows over the last year to what is the issue of our time, which is the hollowing out of middle class jobs. And so, but I've come away feeling a little empty, like the solutions are just palliative. They're, you know, whether it be, you know, raise the minimum wage or more entrepreneurship education, or it just, or, you know, this guy, Jaron Lanier, who is a big Microsoft guy, talked about micropayments so that anytime anybody posted a comment on YouTube or whatever, he'd get paid a little bit. Though somehow don't feel like they're really the answer to the hollowing out of middle-class jobs. So I decided to go a little more broadly, as I said, go a little out of the box, and talk with a science fiction writer who also happens to be a futurist. His name is Carl Schroeder, and his sci-fi novels, they speculate on things such as nanotechnology, the impacts of that, and future impacts, something called terraforming, augmented reality, interstellar travel. But he's also got a philosophical bent, and perhaps more important. Well, let me first give him a little credit for his sci-fi writing. His book, Ventus, was named a New York Times notable book. But on the future, he is also a futurist. Prefers that less crystal ball-ian term, strategic foresight. He's consulted with the Canadian government. He's from Canada. Consulted with the Canadian government, and some of his ideas were sent directly to the Prime Minister's office. And now he is senior foresight strategist for Idea Couture. It's a consultancy that does focus on strategic foresight with offices in Toronto and San Francisco. How did I hear about this guy? I was reading a series of science fiction writers' predictions, which were the cover story of a recent popular science magazine. And I found this guy's predictions most intriguing. Carl Schroeder, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Hi, Marty. How are you doing?
I am well. Thanks for giving me part of your Sunday.
Hey, no problem.
So, what are some jobs that you predict are going to exist 10 years from now that don't exist now?
Well, it's interesting because we talk a lot about globalization, and you know that's a strong trend. But there's a counter trend that I think is happening, which is what I call localization. And you know, the most important person in my community is actually the teacher at the local dance school. She knows everybody. She knows all the kids. She knows all the parents. You know, when I walk down the street, people hail me not as Carl Schroeder, but as my daughter's dad, right? it's the people who are the hub of the local community seem to be gaining in importance, even while we're supposedly losing all our jobs to, you know, India and places around the world. So what I did was I looked into the idea of local jobs and local positions, and there's some interesting things happening there.
So what's an example of how, you know, it's very nice to be a hub of the community. I know a lot of these people, they're predominantly women, who tend to love being connectors. They connect people with people. They love referring people to somebody else, but they don't make a living doing that. How does one make a living as a hub of a local community?
Well, it's right now, and this is the problem, is a pretty improvisational space, right? People are making this stuff up as they go along. And that's because these aren't traditional jobs. They don't work in a traditional way. So one of the ones I thought of was what I call a co-housekeeper. You know, I don't know what it's like in San Fran right now, but in Toronto, house prices are skyrocketing. They're through the roof. And young people cannot afford to buy a house.
Right.
So one of the things that's happening is that people are going together. You know, couples will buy a tiny little condo, a 400-square-foot condo for themselves, but then they'll go together with a bunch of friends, and they'll buy what's called a co-house, which is a house that's owned by four or five, you know, six families. And they use it for parties, for having, you know, somewhere to have guests who are in town, for playrooms for the kids and things like that. So one of the jobs I thought of was a co-housekeeper. Somebody who manages one or more of these co-houses in the neighborhood.
So let me play around with some of these ideas. So there's the two concepts of expensive housing that we can afford and localization. So let me do a little brain dump on your core concepts and see what your reaction is. So the localization thing, we tried it and failed it with things like Patch. Patch was actually owned by AOL, and they attempted to create these little websites that are local, that are ultra-local, focusing on what's new and businesses and whatever that deal with the local community. Well, they're just closing down because it didn't work. But what would work? I think that, I'm making this up, but let's say a local concierge, somebody who does, as you say, know everybody and know everything, and maybe creates a website that is ultra-local of all of the best services. It takes Yelp and somehow enhances Yelp. It is the human side of Yelp. Yelp provides zip code zip code screened ratings of all kinds of services, but there's always a need for a human touch. So what if we're talking about a human Yelp, which somebody can call somebody and say, you know, I'm moving to this neighborhood. I need to find a great doctor. I need to find a good hair cutter. I need to find a home repair person. And it's one thing to have the published reviews, which can often be invalid. They're often printed by competitors. But some real human being who's been around that neighborhood for a million years and knows everybody and everything, being the ultimate connector, and they make their money by being hired by the project. You know, it's for people just moving into the neighborhood. They charge, $500 or whatever, and that for that $500, they connect the person with everything. So why don't we call it a human connector? What do you think about that?
Sure, that sounds exactly right. I mean, a friend of mine started a small magazine called Canadian Newcomer Magazine, specifically for new immigrants who want to find their way around, and it worked extremely well. So you've got the idea of hubs. It's connected too to the idea of the sharing economy.
Right.
Now, sharing is really interesting because it's kind of marginal from the point of view of the normal economy. Let's say I own a car, and I used to take it to work every day, but now my job I can commute to. So the car sits there idle for 8 hours a day.
Sure.
Well, why don't I share it?
That's right. The Lyft and Uber here in San Francisco. Those are huge. Lyft and Uber are major services that do that. It's like if you're going to the airport, you can leave your car at the airport, and instead of paying for your airport parking, you get paid, or at least it's a break even, and somebody else borrows it. So absolutely, that makes good sense.
Yeah, the problem with all of these, of course, is that they amount to, they're all partial solutions.
Right.
They're not careers. They're one of the things that form a solution. And my worry is that it would end up being quite exhausting. It's like, you know,
sure,
people who live off of coupons. There's people who actually do nothing but clip coupons and you know, essentially that's their lifestyle. But it's insanely hard work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think putting together 3 and 4 part-time jobs is just not for most people. But you talked about the co-housing thing. Yeah, housing prices here in the Bay Area are also, you know, skyrocketing. Even before they skyrocketed, even when they were at the bottom, they were unaffordable for most people to buy a house. So the idea of, you know, unaffiliated people living together is absolutely booming. So let's see if we can come up with a way of getting a true middle-class living doing that. So if I were, for example, a real estate broker, I might specialize in either selling houses that could be used for that purpose and marketing to that segment of the population, to unaffiliated groups, or I might be a rental agent who specialized in putting together those kind of groups. I might be somebody who... if I was a counselor type, a lot of people in the Bay Area who listen to this show tend to be, you know, helper counselor types. You can be sure that a bunch of unaffiliated people living together, 5 in a house, are going to be wanting to break each other's faces periodically. And so helping to facilitate their getting along, being a counselor in those situations, all of which could potentially offer a middle class living. Now, I agree that none of these solutions are going to solve the macro societal problem. But part of my job here on the show is to give people like a way to survive amid the problem. I mean, the problem may be we need to get a replacement for capitalism, or we may need to completely create a whole new nation of entrepreneurs creating more businesses. But for at least for this segment, we're talking about, you know, what some under the radar things that we never would have thought of that are based on some futuristic thinking that might enable you to find interesting middle class employment now or in the near future. Sound right?
Yeah, and let me, I mean, we've wandered into a really interesting space here. Let me give you a reason why this is really an interesting place to be right now. Because if you talk to the technologists right now, they're all really excited about what they call the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is the idea of connecting everything. So, you know, the cliche is your fridge talks to the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about... finding resources that are not being used. So the whole thing with car sharing and Uber and all these things is that it's getting easier and easier because of the Internet and because of computers to locate resources that aren't being used,
right,
to allocate them, right?
Right.
So so that works for cars. It works for, well, somebody's got the idea of delivering packages. Well, if you're driving across town, you just get a text that says, pick up the package here and drop it off there, because it's on your way, right?
Interesting.
So it's allocation of resources. But the thing is that people's labor and skills are also rapidly becoming unallocated resources, because we're all sitting around idle, waiting for something to do. And the traditional ways of finding work don't work anymore. But that doesn't mean that gigantic labor pool isn't still out there. It is.
Right.
So you can apply the same logic that you use for Uber or Zipcar or you know, any of these sharing economies to labor itself and say, well, over here I got an accountant, over there I've got you know, three guys with really good warehousing experience, and over here I've got this, that, and the other, and I have a need over here.
Yeah, but isn't that, I mean, that's pretty ubiquitous already. I mean, that's what TaskRabbit, that's what Odesk is, that's what 99designs is. There are all these Elance and freelancers and something workbytheHour.com and, you know, all of those places, you know, that's what they do. You can put yourself up and you say, I'm available. There's even something called Fiverr where you say, for $5, I'll do X. You know, I'll create an Excel spreadsheet for you, or I'll create a 10-second doodle whiteboard video for you. But that becomes a race to the bottom, because you've got people all over the world doing it. So there's some person in Pakistan or Bangladesh who's willing to, you know, basically jump through the moon for $10. Is that really a solution? And is that also, because there are all these independent jobs, doesn't that mean, again, you're going to be running a five-ring circus life?
Maybe for now. The thing about if the Internet of Things gets easier and easier, and the logistics of the sharing economy get easier and easier, then this kind of thing also gets easier and easier. So what we're at right now is basically at the crappy front end of an economic revolution, where all this stuff exists, but it doesn't work very well, and it's not providing a solution to ordinary people right now. But that doesn't mean it's not going to change and develop rapidly. It also doesn't mean that it's the entire solution. But what it indicates is a massive change in the way that we do work. The other thing is the big irony here is that if you go around the world to, say, India or Thailand or places like this, you find out that the middle class is expanding rapidly, right?
Yeah.
That most places in the world, the middle class is growing like crazy. Mm. The hollowing out of the middle class seems to be a phenomenon that's happening here.
Right. It makes sense.
And yeah, and I don't know, you know, whether this is that all those jobs are moving somewhere else, whether those the newer economies are structuring themselves differently to begin with. We got to find out.
Well, I want to respond to that. There's a number of factors that lead to that. Number one is, you know, we are a very benevolent country, and we're in a phase in America where we're trying to provide more and more to workers so that, whether it's the latest thing, which is Obamacare or paid family leave or worker or protections like the Americans with Disabilities Act or workers' comp or, you know, Social Security or disability, et cetera, the cost of American is very much higher. And so, especially in a global economy, where a lot of the work can be done, work product can be sent over the internet, it's, you know, employers makes, they're going to be hiring these in Thailand, et cetera. And that's why the cost, the average salary of Americans is going down. The employment rate and under full employment rate is going down in America, but it's going to go up and the middle class is going to increase in places like Thailand, Bangladesh, et cetera. Does that make sense?
I think that might be part of it. I think that I don't tend to think of economics, especially capitalist economics, as a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is where for one person to win, somebody else has to lose. And I think the whole idea behind capitalism is that we all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and it generally works. That through trade and commerce, I get richer and you get richer. Sometimes that doesn't work. We're in the middle of a rough patch, and maybe we're going through a phase change into something entirely different. I don't know. But I'm not one of the people who tends to think that, that our money is flowing there. And that's the reason for the problem.
There I don't agree with you, because, you know, if I've got a job and I need an accountant, there's new jobs only get, first of all, new jobs only get created, net get created through entrepreneurship, through new businesses, new products, new services. Otherwise, if it's just coming out of redistribution, it's, you know, whether it be taxation, it's going to cost jobs. Or if, you know, in most often, there it's going to be a situation where an employer, small one person like me, for example, I'm getting a whiteboard video, a doodle video made of how to train teachers to deal with gifted kids in a regular class. Well, I did a lot of very careful searching, and I'm going to hire that person either here or, you know, I assess the pros and cons of hiring somebody here locally, somebody in America versus somebody in Indonesia. And, it is a zero sum game. I'm either going to hire that person here. I'm going to hire them in Indonesia. And, and frankly, I do consider it jingoistic and, rather chauvinistic to prioritize intrinsically by American. So I'm going to be able to get that whiteboard video made by an international team, as it happens. There's this firm, and he's based in New Jersey, but all his workers, he's got a great artist whom he loves who works in Indonesia. He's got a great computer geeky person who knows this thing called Camtasia who works in Pakistan. And I'm going to get it for literally 80% less than the lowest bid I could get from an all-American person. So it is a zero-sum game, in at least not completely, but largely. Does that make sense?
Only if the growth of the middle class in other countries is being fueled by this process. But if if people in Indonesia are getting wealthier because they're selling to Indonesians, because they're creating services for Indonesians, because they're building factories that sell in Indonesia, then no. Certainly there's a problem on our end, but they're not winning at our expense. Maybe we're losing at their expense, but they're not winning at our expense.
You're listening to Work with Marty. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please finish.
But this raises a whole question of what we consider work. You know, 100 years ago, a woman gets up at 6 in the morning. She cleans the house. She, takes care of the fire. She goes, gets firewood. She draws water. She brings it in. She takes care of the kids all day. She darns. She knits, right? She cooks food. She prepares everything. You know, she goes to bed exhausted at the end of the day. She doesn't get paid a cent for that. Now, is she working? Right? That is fundamentally, finally, the question that we have to answer. Are the people who are sitting around, highly skilled workers, trying to do something with their lives, are they working if they're not getting paid for it? It doesn't have to be redistribution, but how do people get paid? That's for the work that they do. That's kind of the question that we have to ask ourselves at this point.
Indeed. You are listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with Carl Schrader. He is both an acclaimed science fiction writer and a futurist, which he prefers to be called, having somebody with a strategic foresight specialist, so he doesn't sound like he's just looking into a crystal ball. But now we'd like to try to help you. It's one thing to talk in the abstract about future trends, but if you are looking for some out-of-the-box solution to your figuring out what the hell you want to be when you grow up, even if you're already grown up, we invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, is there another kind of work other than what you've already discussed that you think is a likely prospect for becoming a reality in the next 10 years that we wouldn't normally think of now?
Well, you know, we've kind of covered a lot of ground. The one area that work is going to come from is the simple demographics, that where people are getting older. And you already see this happening in Japan, where with an aging population, you use up more and more of the younger population just taking care of them. And again, without asking who pays, the fact is that taking care of is going to have to happen.
Yep.
So there's going to be a lot more work for geriatric care and everything that goes around that, whether it's health care, whether it's transport. It's essentially a new opportunity, basically, based on age.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So let me riff off that. We all know about the healthcare thing. So the healthcare provider thing is going to grow. So what are some other, I'm going to try to suggest some things that capitalize on, if that's not quite the right word, that the aging boomers are going to need and where there could be help for them. We were talking real estate earlier, so indeed helping people find the right assisted living facilities, whether as brokers or consultants, might make sense. Things like selling long-term care insurance. It could also be there are, for better or worse, of course, there's a man I decry this, but there are 4.5 widows for every widower, and so finding services that serve widows who may have not been really savvy about money or living on their own, services dealing with widows, elders who have some discretionary income certainly do more travel. Unfortunately, sometimes it's medical travel. And as our system here, when we have 50 million more people covered under Obamacare with the same number of doctors and nurses, there's a lot of people who are going to seek traveling, trying to combine personal travel with getting health care, whether it be dental care or other kinds of health care abroad. And so brokers who are experts at helping people find high-quality medical care abroad might be options. Does any of those resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, when you said brokers, I mean, this is the thing, is that what we have is a broad need for people to make connections and to coordinate and to simplify. For instance, healthcare navigation is becoming definitely a job. The more that you can put a human face on that, the more likely you are to find work. And that actually goes for everything. The better you are with people, mm-hmm. the more creative you are,
yep.
The more likely you are in this emerging economy to find work.
I agree. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of lines lighted up. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and my guest, Carl Schrader. What is your question or comment for him or me? Hello, it's you. Are you there? Hi.
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Okay. My name is Siva.
Hi, Siva. That's my mom's name.
You're kidding.
I swear.
How does she spell it?
S-E-V-A, not S-I-V-A like the Indian goddess.
Well, I'm the same religion as your mother, but my mother spelled it S-I-V-A.
Okay.
So here's my passion. I'm a retired math teacher. I taught in the public schools, the secondary schools in for the San Francisco Unified School District, and I noticed that half the kids sort of understood math, and the other half did not, because they were taught in a rote kind of way without any math understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied with a woman by the name of Mary Laycock, who was the head math teacher at Nueva Day School for only gifted mm-hmm. youngsters.
Right.
And she was passionate about teaching math concepts through manipulatives.
Right.
So under her idea, I've invented a lot of games and activities that help kids and adults see the math concepts. I've got one at Talbot's Toyland in San Mateo, where I now live, called the Visual Math Addition and Subtraction Kit.
I'm going to be tough on you. We've been talking about manipulatives to teach math concepts for 100 years, and there's 10 zillion kits out there that do that. Why would you want to be,
because
example number 1,000,001? Is yours really so much?
Mine is better because the kits do not have, they have ones and tens and hundreds. But you know what? If you look at our models, they all have fives. The human mind cannot grasp more than four or five. So we have a chunk that's called a nickel, or we have a chunk that's called a $5 bill. And we need that chunk to think with. So
You know what? I'm going to interrupt you. Did you have a question or comment for my guest?
What do I do with this stuff?
I would say find another project. On this one, I can't be optimistic when I don't really feel that way. I think that's been done a million times in one variation or another.
No.
Anyway, I'm going to go to the next call. Well, sorry about that. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Carl Schrader. What's your question or comment for him or me?
Hi, Marty. I'm asking you and your guest to look into the crystal ball and help my son, who just graduated with a political science degree, magna cum laude,
mm-hmm.
and he's had a little work experience. He has very strong math skills. He's, in fact, tutoring high school kids right now mm-hmm. for an organization that helps the underserved go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And he's passionate about both math and analytical thinking and writing, but he's decided that his best bet is to try to find a sales job. He's also really good with people, and he's had some success in sales. So,
okay.
Out of all this, what guidance would you give?
Okay, Carl, why don't you take a first crack at it, and then I'll follow up. Go ahead.
Well, it sounds like he's on the right track. I mean, one of the smartest kids I know went into general contracting right out of high school. Power drills and saws and his whole idea is, well, he's going to make money at this for 10 years, and then he's going to pay his way through college, university, come out debt-free on the other side with a degree, and then he'll do something, right? A lot of the success that's happening these days is from people not taking the going from high school to straight into university and to a career track job route, but by doing trades, doing high paying work in some other area, and then coming back later on. Now, I went out. I got out of high school. I actually dropped out of high school into the middle of a recession in 1980-81. What I usually tell people is it took me 25 years to become an overnight success. And that can happen.
You know what? I'm gonna take a shot at something. My typical modus operandi is to combine different pieces of the elements that a caller gives. So, if I were him, I'm a caller. What's your first name, by the way?
My first name is Lee.
Lee. My first shot at this would be to have him sell statistical packages. He's a math guy. He does want to make money. He's not averse to selling.
But he's very good with people, and he's
right.
People just want to deal with him. He's got that sort of.
Got it. There are many, many products, especially in an era of big data or biotechnology or bioinformatics, where the understanding of statistics is key. And if he is good at math and is good enough to be able to tutor, which means he's be able to explain mathematical concepts. Yeah. I'm wondering whether he should be selling some of that software that's designed to analyze big data and make probabilistic decisions, for example, about, you know, which gene cluster is most likely to be causal of this cancer. And that way there's both money in it, it uses his math background, and it's very pro-social. Does that make sense?
That's great, but can you give me some examples, some names of companies?
Well, Let me think. Oracle is the key, of databases. So Oracle would be one. Biotech. I would, I don't know the names of these biotech software companies, but what I would do would be, I always, go to Google. We underestimate it, but Google is very potent as a tool if you search well. So, for example, I would use a prediction software. Big data analytics software and see which, what comes up. And if he's been in political science, I've got a better idea.
Okay.
Given that he's got a poli-sci degree, there is tremendous amount of predictive software that is used to predict for political campaigns, which candidate, which districts should a candidate put his money in, canvas, etc. So what I would put political campaign software. He should be selling software for them. That's my best shot.
So you think that predictive analytics is the area?
But I think specifically, given that he's got the poli-sci degree, I've now revised my suggestion. Uh-huh. Let him look at political campaign software. And I imagine he'll find a lot of companies, because this is becoming a very statistical art to know which, in every election, it's very often an election comes down to one zip code, one little, 10 block area that is swing voters. And focusing all your efforts on those swing voters can make all the difference. That's what the software can do, and that will be ever more in demand. And that might be the perfect amalgamation of his poli-sci background, his math background, and his desire to sell. All right. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Any comments, Carl? Should I go back to the phones?
No, that's perfect. I like the way we're drilling down to specific examples here. It's great.
Good. Then let's drill down one more time, and let's welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
My name is Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a very strong sales background.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my early 60s. I've got a college degree from the University of Colorado. I feel like I'm still at the top of my game, though I know age plays a factor. Also, I have an elderly mother, a daughter with autism, and a son that's just starting college. So I can't afford to continue, and my salary has declined. But I also need to do something that's probably home-based or has some flexibility. In the old days in sales, you could find, things with flexibility. I wanted to see if you had any suggestions. I've done sales in the hotel convention sales, advertising. I've done recruiting, 10 years as a recruiter in construction and education. All of those industries have been impacted by the recession.
Okay, Carl, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, the fact is that you've got a very large amount of experience and expertise in a particular area, and the first thing I would think of is if you've got these particular needs right now, then a lot of other people must too, and I would look for other people in the same situation who are facing the same issues. And I would get together and I would say, okay, how do we solve this together? Because right now you're talking about what do I do? And it's kind of a cold and lonely place to be out there trying to solve problems in a changing economy where the whole world is changing all at the same time, all by yourself. I think the best first thing to do is find other people in the same sort of situation and start tackling the problem as a group.
Laura, that's a collectivist position. Now I'm going to share what you might do individually. Again, trying to amalgamate the individual things that, you know, the individual attributes that you've got. You've done sales. You've done hotel sales. I'm wondering, you know, there are certain careers in which sales, being an older person, is a plus in sales, and certain where it's a minus. Certainly in the, you know, in the space of the shared economy or in the space of social networking, your age is a minus. But had you thought about being someone who did real estate sales, specializing in either downsizing adults or helping to sell assisted living facilities? That's much of that could still be done at home. And in fact, working by phone, many older people don't like to get out very much and are most easily accessible by phone. Had you thought about trying to sell assisted living facilities or assisted living services or rentals? What do you think about that?
I can look into that. I used to have a real estate license. I never used it. But certainly that's something that I could definitely take a look at. And, that would be one industry. Can you think of any others?
Sure. Again, home-based sales, when I'm trying to think of selling to older people, the first thing that comes to mind is insurance. We all don't like to think about insurance, but as we get older, whether it be long-term health care insurance or amid Obamacare, how to, you know, whether you're selling a product that is approved by the Obama exchanges or whatever, but help people are scared to death that there won't be access. You know, with 50 million more people covered under Obamacare and the same number of doctors, nurses, hospitals, MRI machines, operating rooms, people are scared to death. So being somebody who helps older people find insurance that is going to be affordable and give them reasonable access could be a tremendous opportunity for you to do at home. Make sense?
That does make sense. And that also makes me, I've been wondering about healthcare. Is there anything in healthcare that you can think of that I could do? I've worked extensively with nurses, like, you know, in education. I've also worked with the Arizona Nurses Association as a consultant.
Needing to make more money than I think you're going to be able to get to branching out in the new field. The only other thing that I would suggest is I remember you saying you had an autistic kid.
So
being somebody who brokers services for autistic adult, your kid, if you're in your 60s, I'm assuming your kid is an adult.
No.
Okay.
No, I've got a young family.
Okay. Then one of the possibilities is to work either for a company that provides autism services, either in sales, since you are a salesperson, because if you need to make real money, the way to make real money is to be selling yourself, because if you're just a service provider, you're not adding dollars to the nonprofit or the company. So I'm wondering whether you should be selling services for autistic kids or their families as an alternative. Just another thought where you might have an edge.
Okay.
All right, Laura.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome. Okay, Carl, we have time for just one more question. You know, we've talked about individual jobs, but take a shot at the hardest question of all. There is no question that the middle class is hollowing out. The super skilled and super able are doing just fine. The middle class, ever more employers are either automating or part-timing. And the jobs that are remaining are crappy $10 an hour jobs. And even those, as we try harder to give more money to the minimum wage workers, give them a living wage, there's tremendous efforts to roboticize. Even Starbucks has now working on an automated version of a barista. Do you have any thoughts on the big question of what the hell is going to happen? What do you predict 20 or 30 years from now is going to happen as a result of this evisceration of middle-income earning jobs?
Well, you know, I hate predicting, but let's drive it to the limit. What happens if everything gets automated, right? So all the manufacturing is automated, warehousing is automated, transport is automated. All of these jobs go away. Then one of the things that happens is that the companies that have done this automation no longer have anybody to sell to. So it's not just a problem for the middle class, The lower class, you know, jobs go away too when you get things like, good robotics and things like that. So the entire consumer base goes away.
Right.
If you can't pay them, so it's a problem for corporations too.
Right.
And some people have proposed a very, very high corporate taxes. That get paid back in social services. But one of the simplest solutions is actually going to be voted in a referendum in Switzerland sometime, I think, this year. And it's something that's been experimented with here in Canada and in the U.S. Called the Guaranteed Basic Income.
Right.
Where you do away with all these complicated, costly, bureaucratic, gigantic social services and just cut everybody, every adult citizen in the country a check every month for about $2,500. It costs about the same as maintaining all of those big bureaucracies, but you don't have Big Brother saying, you can have a check, but you can't. Everybody gets the money.
Right.
And where we've experimented with this, both here in the U.S., it's generally been successful. The U.S. experiments have shown that some people slack off because they're getting free money. In Canada, we found that about 1% of males worked less, which is a pretty amazing result.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was higher for teens, but when they looked into it, they found out that the teens weren't getting jobs because they were actually going back to school. So doing that and having higher, let's say, corporate tax.
Won't that kill jobs? If you have higher corporate taxes, won't that just make corporations want?
We're talking about a situation where the jobs are getting killed anyway, right? Where the jobs are getting killed off by another process, but the corporations are still around, and actually they're getting more and more efficient because they're automating.
Yeah.
Right. So in that situation, you have the consumers. Everyone's getting a check every month. So if you're making toothpaste, you know that there's a guaranteed market for toothpaste out there, right?
Yep.
You know how much money there's going to be for buying necessities and that people will be able to afford them.
So there's your good example, though. You didn't pick toothpaste at random. So what that implies is that we're going to have, everything more equal, and everybody will be able to afford the basics, but nobody will be able to afford, very few people will be able to afford more than the very basics. So any company that's creating anything like, cars, where it's discretionary, do you need a car? Do you need a new car? Could you buy an old beater? Should you, just buy a little scooter or a bicycle? It seems as though all but the most basic products, basic food, basic, toiletries, basic shelter, basic transportation, very basic health care, that will be provided for all, and that all the rest of it, companies will say just is too small a base to afford to, for example, Toyota will probably go out of business because they can't make a living, if only a small percentage of people can buy new cars. So is it really just we're going to go back to a much simpler, less material-based society where everybody's more equal but everybody's living much more basically?
That would be one extreme. The other possibility would be that people have time on their hands and they don't like to be idle and they want to do stuff. So they invent new kinds of work, new kinds of products, new kinds of entrepreneurship, and new jobs.
Yep.
And that a new economy grows. And I have absolutely no idea what that new economy would be based around. I can't tell you that. But one of the things that's happened over the last 100 years is that whenever we automate some whole class of jobs, other jobs spring up somewhere else, and they're generally things that we never imagined. I don't think that most people want to sit around on their hands.
Right, I agree.
I lean more towards the optimistic scenario.
Great.
Where a new economy would develop.
And it's a wonderful way to end, and that brings us to, really, that was probably the modal response among all the experts that I've had coming on, that really the way in which the economy, or not the economy so much because that implies too much materialism, but the positive outcome that is most likely is there will be a series of small, simple entrepreneurial businesses that will start as automation does give people more time on their hands and they're forced to come up with new ideas, and that like in previous generations, that will keep people well employed. And my little addition to that is that we can stoke those fires by replacing some of the arcane curriculum that exists in our public schools, learning quadratic equations and the causes of the Peloponnesian War and stochastic processes with ethical entrepreneurship education so that more people could have the skills to start those. What's your reaction to that last comment?
I love it. I think that's bang on.
Well, on that point of agreement, it was bang on for you to give me some of your Sunday. I really appreciate your coming on the show. Carl Schrader is both a science fiction writer. His most acclaimed book is Ventus, but he's written a lot more. You can Google just the word Carl Schrader, spelled KarlSchroeder, and you will no doubt get to his stories and his future strategic planning stuff and his books. Carl Schrader, thanks again for being a guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks a lot, Marty. It was fun.
Good. Take care. And we've got a few minutes left, so if you have a career-related problem of any sort, in the here and now, not the future, I would like to try to help you or someone you love who's got the career-related problem. The phone number here for what I call a three-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, Washington Post recently published an article provocatively called 10 Bold Predictions for 2014. And again, one of the main themes of this show is that to survive in a tough economy job-wise, it's important to go under the radar. So I talk a lot about under-the-radar careers. Here are some kind of long-shot predictions for 2014. See if any of these stimulate any ideas for you in terms of your employability. Actually, before I get to those predictions, there's something called iBeacon, which is maybe the breakthrough product that has gotten the least attention, which I really like. When you're walking around with your smartphone and you're in a store or you're in a neighborhood, it would print out in-the-moment coupons. It senses that you're in Home Depot in the section that's selling doors. And so they may give you a coupon. If you'll buy one of our doors, you'll get an instant 10% off. Or if you are in a museum, it'll give you automated museum tours. So I would try to be – I can't help but think that the company that makes iBeacon is going to really grow. So go Google iBeacon and see if you might – if that's the kind of company you might want to work for. And again, you don't need to be a techie. You know, every company utilizes people in human resources, in accounting, in employee screening. Go to iBeacon and see, if that – maybe there's a job that you might want to do there. This now I'm going to the predictions. Actually, not because the phones are lines alight. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi. I've been a computer programmer for 20 years in a legacy computing environment.
Right.
So I don't know or have experience or certification in the hot areas like Java or cloud computing.
You're an IBM 360 guy or something or like that, or Pascal or something.
Somewhat similar, yes.
Okay.
But in any event, it looks like that my programming job is going to be phased out.
Right.
And so what I'm considering is getting out of programming but staying in IT or related field.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could recommend some under-the-radar careers in IT or related fields that might be appropriate for me.
Yeah, I think the one under-the-radar concept is this. What is legacy in the United States is considered state-of-the-art in Africa and Latin America and even in Eastern Europe. And so if you're at all either open to relocating to one of those places or just remotely being kind of a systems administrator, who can solve these kind of problems, or somebody who develops kind of custom tweaks and fixes for whatever. What is your expertise in programming? What are the languages? What is the platforms that you're most expert in?
Well, it's actually a language that is it's called a multi-value database. It's not SQL. It's not a structured query language or based on tables. It's different than that. And the programming language is kind of a hybrid of, it's kind of like a basic programming language.
Okay, who uses it outside the United States? Do you know? What kind of businesses use it?
There are a few businesses, I think, maybe in the UK that use it. But for the most part, it's kind of being phased out overseas also.
Okay. So let's see. If you didn't want to try to, you know, it seems to me you only need, if it were me, the first, before I tried anything else, my way would be to see which companies, you know, you say you've been doing it a long time. You're not 30 years old anymore. You want to do something probably for 5 years. Find those few companies in, you know, not just even in the UK, but finding those even more under the radar companies in countries where they're just not changing very rapidly, and being a consultant to 3 or 4 or 5 of them remotely, I would think that I would certainly check that out first. It's not going to hurt you, you know, not going to take you that much time to find out which companies are using that particular program. And if that didn't work, then probably what I would do is, so I want to understand more about your skills. Do you picture, you say you want to get out of programming, but you want to stay in IT. I mean, the major job titles tend to be more like systems administrator, networking specialist. Where outside of the programming space do you feel you've got where you could legitimately convince an employer to hire you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'd probably have to be retrained. The reality is that I'd need more training and something else. I guess just with the programming, it gets very tedious, you know, going through thousands of lines of code a day.
Then what if you went easy? You know, Python and HTML are written to avoid writing tons and tons of code, thousands and thousands of lines. Or you know, it wouldn't take too much. If you've been working on legacy languages, they're probably a lot harder. Had you thought about just getting up to speed enough on HTML or Python, so that you could be hired as a programmer, because those are really in demand languages that aren't as hard. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that would be something I'd look into. The other thing I was thinking is maybe learning some application and being an expert in a given application. Maybe something that's under the radar that people don't think of, but there's kind of a unseen demand for. So I was thinking maybe some suggestions in an area like that.
Good. Tell me about an industry. Then in every industry, there are generic software, things like Oracle and Salesforce and IBM, you know, CRM, you know, customer relation management software. But under the radar is going to be more industry specific. Is there a particular field, whether it be dentists or whatever, is there a particular field you know something about and are interested in where you could become the expert in that software?
Well, I've kind of been a generalist in the industry that I'm programming in, so I haven't really...
What's the industry?
Healthcare.
Okay, great. Well, that's what I would do. I would try to find some niche within healthcare, probably whether it be electronic medical records or it be medical diagnostics or whatever. Look for what are some cool specialties, and that's why I mentioned dentistry. Find some niche, some little healthcare niche, and that, I'm looking at the clock, and that is all the time we have, so that's my best shot for today. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko. And, of course, I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on calls. And my wife, Barbara Nemko, and I are going to discuss the art, the science, the psychology of grooming your replacement. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we do find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemko's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemko.com. That's martynemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco, local public radio, online at klw.org.